Hey John, did you watch that video I sent to you, John?
Is that music coming through?
Yes.
All right.
John, did you watch the video I sent?
Wait till after we go for the introduction. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly call. Today is Monday, July 31st, 2023. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're listening live over a radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on a weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, it's plural, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. You can also support us by purchasing the books, Government by Consent and Court Access in the Common Law, also found on the right-hand side of our website. Also, please support our NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on a donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up on our scripture reading where we left off last week. We were in, Hebrews, and picking up on chapter 8 of Hebrews, read by Alexander Scorby.
Chapter 8. Now of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such an high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched, and not man. For every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices, wherefore it is of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer. For if he were on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law, who serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle. For, see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern showed to thee in the mount. But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second. For finding fault with them, he saith, Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not, saith the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for all shall know me from the least to the greatest. For I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. In that he saith, A new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away.
All right, Jan, do we have any questions or any announcements this week? If you're talking, Jan, your mic is muted.
Well, I was looking for that
bad little devil, huh?
It was evasive today. yes, we have about three questions today. Well, one of them is really a wish or a statement. It starts out, I urge and highly recommend that you submit a criminal complaint against that Supreme Court judge to the U.S. Navy Judicial Advocate General's Corps, JAG, to the attention of Vice Admiral Darcy E. Crandall, Jr., Chief Judge, ASAP, especially since they are the ones who have been and who are conducting all the military warrants, arrests, tribunals, and executions. JAG just executed by hanging Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, so on. The audio cast and the link is short. They give the address for the Judge Advocates General's Corps if you wanted to do something with that. Is that something you would be interested in, John?
Well, send me a copy of that. I don't know that I have that. Just send me a copy. I'll take a look at that. Okay. I don't believe the governor has been executed. We hear a lot of different things like that, and we got to be careful on what is out there. There's a lot of people saying things that are not true, And sometimes it makes it difficult to know the difference between what is accurate and what isn't accurate. I've heard a lot of things like that, and I don't know, I'm just kind of very leery of it. We need some real good sources to, and needs to come from numerous sources before we can even talk about those things. But I do know that JAG is maybe the way to go, as well as other things that we've been doing. So we're thinking, well, we're going to add that on. I know that individual mentioned some names. I'll look into the names that he mentioned if you send me a copy of that email.
Okay, the second one is unclear. There was an article, I think, 2 weeks ago on Rumble about a Virginia school board. 84% of the parents there opposed the teaching that they were doing, and they ignored them. This is suggesting that they should be removed from office. How would one go about doing that?
Yeah, well, okay. You, first of all, to do things the right way, you have to get a number of people behind you. You got to get the sheriff behind you. And that's what we're trying to teach people, to create these committees of safety within their county. And there's a process to get the sheriff on board with you. You have to educate that sheriff. All this takes a little bit of time. And I don't know that anyone could get to that point within less than 3 months. And I would say 3 months from the time period you have your first real meeting, really sort of a conference in the sense of, you know, inviting people to the first meeting and giving an introduction, sort of a seminar. I will strongly suggest to do that on a Saturday, maybe from noon to four, probably less than 4 hours, but it could take 4 hours. I know meetings that I usually run take 4 hours at least. So as far as, you know, an introduction to what we're doing here at National Liberty Alliance, we've got all the tools and necessary things in order to do that up under Start a Committee of Safety, and you go to handbooks, videos, and tools there, and you'll find all this information and different videos or PowerPoints you can use in order to give that introduction. And you can also see the introduction that we've given on our front page, and you can mirror that. And again, so we have all that in different videos. You could do it in different orders and so on and so forth. There's various ways to do it. But, you know, before you do that, you want to get at least, you know, maybe 6, 8, 10 or more people together that's kind of working on a plan to then have your first introduction. And you should hope by the time you get that out, maybe you'll pull 20 people all together, maybe more. And you'll grow over the course of a couple of months. As you're growing, there is a process to talk with the sheriff and meet with the sheriff. You first, again, want to educate that sheriff. First order of business is to get the book to the sheriff, government by consent. And then you do a follow-up meeting maybe a month or two later. But you have to be organized before you do that. You have to have, you know, the resolutions in place. So you have to be prepared. And you have to have, charter. And you want to put it together in a booklet form. I mean, again, we teach all this. We lay it out in a book. There's examples of all this stuff on this page right here. At that point, once you've done that, and then the sheriff finally comes on board because, again, if you've educated him a little bit, he understands what you're doing by giving him a copy of your charter and your resolutions. And again, that takes about 3 months to get to that point, roughly speaking. And for other people, it'll take longer than that, but depends on how people progress in this. Then that's when you can go to these boards and deal with these boards. And we have a plan for that, which we've spoken about numerous times. I'm not going to get into it at this moment unless I'm specifically asked by someone in a queue or something. But I am writing a paper on that, which will detail a process. People can add or deal with that process however they wish. But basically, you know, there is a plan, and you have to get that sheriff educated. But again, once you go to the board, there is a process. You want the sheriff or one of his deputies there to serve a paper, and that paper would be served if they refuse to be obedient to the people. And there should be a lot of people at that particular meeting, you know, with the board. Then you're able to remove them from office after 10 days if they don't respond correctly. So, again, you know, a lot of this information is on this page in a paper I'll be writing detailing the process. Hopefully I'll get to that soon. I'm just finishing up on a major paper. I think I'll be finished with that tomorrow, and then I'm moving towards, maybe I'll do the next thing is write that paper.
Do you know of any particular law, regulation, or procedure once the Committee of Safety is formed that they can use? I'm not familiar with school board members. I haven't dealt with them in 40 years.
Well, yeah, again, there's a process. It could be called a notice and demand. I would call it a quo warranto. I think a quo warranto is much more a better word to use and a better part of the process. But you could do it in two different ways. Once they're served, they have 10 days to respond with their oath bonds and their financials, which they probably won't. And you need to have that served at the meeting by the sheriff or deputy. And once that's done, within 10 days, then they file the necessary papers, and you can go through enforcement on that. And again, they're removed from office within 10 days. You'd make notification with the clerk. And again, all these details, I'm going to write them up and get them in. I don't know that any of the committees of safety are at that part of the process. And again, there was a plan in order to get a lot of people to this group, to this particular board meeting, particularly for schools. But you could do this with any board, town board, village board, and so on. But you want to get enough people at the meeting, so you may have 20, 30 people at the time, but you should have a lot more than that once you follow through with the process of informing the people within that particular school district of what's going on and have a pre-meeting in preparation, what your the most important things that have to be, covered at that board meeting, and command them to do what needs to be done or remove them from office. And that then the process, and again, I'll write this all up.
So, yeah, if I remember.
But I would not approach this without going through it properly. You're not going to have the clout without the sheriff. You're not going to have the clout without a full room, standing room only. You're not going to have the clout unless you're coming with one accord and unless you understand how the process works and what papers to file. You're not going to have the clout. You're not going to get them to do anything because they're all corrupt. They're all lost. That's what it appears to be anyway. I'm surprised that the school boards are this bad, but they are. I mean, look what they're doing in our schools. So, again, if you want to be successful at it, you need to follow a protocol. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, if I remember right, there was like 20 parents involved in that, so they certainly had the numbers to do it. Next question. Apparently people are getting upset with their school board, and that's about time in schools. What is the best way to request an inventory of a public school's books?
Well, that should be able to be accomplished to just go up and talk with, I'd go to the office of a particular school and ask for that information. We could probably Google this if you kind of start researching and throwing some information into a search engine and start to do some research and find out, how all this works in your particular area. I would imagine also addressing the school board. They're probably not going to answer you, or because they don't want you to know what they're teaching your children. But who knows? Maybe they will. But you can go to school and ask for a list of what the curriculum is and what books they're using from first grade to eighth grade or high school or whatever. I mean, I don't know that they will, but they should.
Okay, that was the last question for tonight, John.
Right. Okay, no announcements or anything?
No.
All right. Let me open up the queue here. I don't think I opened up the queue yet. Before I do that, let's see, Ross, you had a question or something? Matter of fact, let me open up the queue. Get into the queue, Ross. I'll see you in there. So, Ross, if you wanted to ask a question or something, I know you had something you piped in a little earlier, you can get into the queue. All right, let me take first person here. We've got four people in the queue right now. Anybody else wants to get in there? Welcome. We'll take Cynthia first. Let's see. What am I doing here? Nope, wrong one. Okay, Cynthia, you got the mic. Go right ahead.
Aloha, John.
Aloha.
Aloha. I wanted to quick comment on that woman looking for information on textbooks for her school. We here in Hawaii, we go and create a FOIA request in order to get that information from Department of Education. So I don't know if that helps, but it's probably a FOIA request. And
It's pretty sad that you have to do a FOIA request to get that. That sounds about right.
Sounds about right because they're hiding everything and it puts them on the spot. So that would be for us here in Hawaii, we have to actually go and create an account with the state system and then go and do the FOIA request. So that's just something we've learned, and I don't know if that'll help anybody. So
well, you know, another way to do it is go see your congressman and see if they'll do anything for you. You know, I don't know how that would work. You know, you have your state representatives also. You know, you can go see your assemblyman who represents your area or one of your senators, state senators, who represents your area. And ask them to get that information. They should be able to get that information without a FOIA. That's another way to try it.
It
is sad. As a matter of fact, we need to think about that. And I'll look further into that to see what I might be able to write, because that's something you should be doing as soon as you start building your committee of safety. You should be doing that, getting that FOIA, and if that's necessary. I'd first go to request the information on the different schools, the ones that you're going to approach first, maybe. And then if they don't respond, then go through the process with a FOIA. And that's going to take some time. How long did it take for your FOIA to go through and get the info?
Well, we weren't specifically requesting that. We were. I was requesting, and other people have requested information from the Department of Education. And some of the easy questions were answered in a few weeks. And then there's still ones that are open from 6 months ago. And, for example, is people wanting to know exactly how money was spent during COVID with their ESSER funds, and surprisingly, they're not answering that. Mm-hmm. So I can't remember the exact question, but that's the other thing here is once we create an account with our state, then I can go in and look at other FOIA requests that have been made, and then I can just simply click on and ask to get an update on that when it does come about. And like I finally got one, someone had requested the Department of Education, because here in Hawaii, the Department of Education is run by the state. There's no individual school boards, which is very, you know, difficult in a lot of ways for things. But so they didn't have an updated, and the Department of Education did not have an annual budget report or an audit for, I don't know, several years. And so now they put one out and they notified me, oh, we're done now. So then it's actually up on the Department of Education. But that took 6 months to even get that.
That you should be able to pursue through the controller. Okay, because the controller, you know, handles all the budgets, and they have to be reporting to the controller, I think, quarterly, maybe less, but quarterly, I think they have to report. Anybody that's getting money from the government, it comes through the controller. And so that's probably the fastest way to get it, and it's already probably there. They're just really dragging their feet. You know, the sad thing about this whole thing is that FOIA was put together, which is a Freedom of Information Act request, and the FOIA was put together to require and force these people to give information that they don't want to give.
Yep.
And they turned around and they use it for everything.
Yep.
I mean, everything you want. You want to go get a list of the people within your county, within your district to walk papers in order to sign, you know, sign petitions to get people onto the ballot, you have to run a FOIA. Unless you're in the party, you've got to run a FOIA. You know, I know as a contractor, I always used to go into different offices, city office, town offices, or whatever, and look at their maps for whatever construction is going on or anything that's been filed. And we used to get it immediately, walk in there, and you pull the maps, you get them, you can make copies and do whatever you want. But then they turned around. So if you wanted to do, for instance, an addition on a particular home or something that was constructed, you go in and you want to get the original papers if you ain't got it. Well, it's a lot of things, you know, just maps. And then all of a sudden, towards the end of my career, they started asking for FOIAs to do that. And, of course, that just builds in more bureaucracy, more time, and, mm-hmm. and it's a real pain. So these people have gotten really, problematic with giving any information. They don't want to give you anything because they know they're all criminals. That's my opinion. Maybe not necessarily the hired bureaucrat. They just are useful mm-hmm. idiots. But the ones controlling this whole thing, I think they're all crooked.
That wasn't my question, but I wanted to hopefully help that woman or whoever.
Yeah, I understand.
A couple weeks ago, you had mentioned that at some point you had done some research and it led to discovering that Q, if I understood this correctly, Q has been around since the time of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, and I wonder if you could expand.
I've heard that Q has something to do with the military. It was around during Lincoln's day, not from the assassination, before that process. And I understand it even goes back further than that. Okay. Now, I haven't done personally any investigation on that, but I've listened to people who I trust who have spoken about that. Matter of fact, I think this guy here, Derek Johnson, spoke about it, which I was just listening earlier.
That's what I was going to ask you, because I have his article up on his website, thedocuments.info, and I read his very long but very informative article, "Can Someone Tell Me What's Really Happening in Ukraine?" And in that article, he lists the website called quantum.gov. And on quantum.gov, the first thing it says is an official website of the United States government. And Derek Johnson was explaining how this, you know, website, that the Quantum Initiative, the National Quantum Initiative Act, became public law December 21, 2018 by President Trump. And so I was just trying to see what else you knew in terms of the history part of it.
Yeah, again, my information, as I said, is secondhand information, particularly from individuals like him, and also S. Giannon. He speaks about it and has spoken about it. And there may be there's a few other people, you know, that I've heard talk about it, but these two individuals I mentioned, I have a good amount of trust to as being valid information. There's a lot of information out on the web, and you got to be careful on what you digest in that, because you're poisoning yourself with a lot of this stuff if you're not careful. It takes a while before you can feel comfortable about an individual who's talking and giving information on whether you can trust the information or not. So.
Mm-hmm. And on that, when I read his article, Derek Johnson, on his thedocuments.info, what's really happening in Ukraine, it's like 178 pages. And what's really interesting is he's basically taking time and stringing together all the different executive orders that he talks about, with all the links that, you know, show people how to go into the Federal Registry and actually digest those executive orders. And it was a very powerful article that really leads me.
Well, that's interesting that you're bringing that kind of information up, because it's exactly what Derek was talking about here on X22. If people aren't familiar with X22 is where I get most of my news. I mean, I got a few places I go to on a daily basis. And I don't have a lot of time really listening to news, but I do get other sources, and sometimes I listen to the BS stuff here or there, little pieces. But in any event, this is X22. Well, let me just show you how to get to this one here. If you know, I go to x22report.com, and down on the bottom in this particular case, he does interviews. And
yeah.
This is the latest interview right here. And he talks very specifically about what you're talking about right now, because he must have spent 20 minutes of this interview just going through the details, the reports, and all of the information out there to prove the fact that, you know, where we are as far as, you know, Trump still being in charge and so on and so forth.
Yep.
John.
I listened to that interview. It was powerful.
Two things.
Yeah.
Hello, who is that?
Yeah, I'm dying, but I'm here. X22 report or spotlight is the interviews, and the report is Dave just giving a report. But all the spotlights is him interviewing somebody.
Right. Yeah, that's down. I was just showing them on the thing. It's down on the bottom of the paper, page. If you just go to x22report.com. You'll see his interviews down on the bottom.
Yeah, and that's Spotlight. That's X22 Spotlight.
Right. Well, it's right here on X22 Report. Right down on the bottom, and you click on it, tells you the latest X22 Report for Spotlight interviews. So you could do it right off X22 Report. And just click on that one, and that's his latest report. I'll probably post this up on the on our website. I'm not sure where, but I'm going to post it up on our website because it's very powerful. And I haven't even finished watching this whole thing or listening. So.
Yeah, and Derek Johnson is getting better at really breaking it down even more simply. I mean, when we first started listening to him. But yeah, it's all fascinating. So anyway, that was my curiosity, just if you had any more information on Q, and I'm sure you have other people in the queue. So thank you very much, everybody.
And that thing that you saw on the government website, I think that was Nezra when they forced Clinton to sign it, the military. That's been a law that they haven't implemented, and I'm pretty sure Derek Johnson talks about that.
Yeah, and it's in his on his website, the thedocuments.info. It's in his article, what's really happening in Ukraine, and it's on page 142 on the PDF, and he just breaks that down. So
I couldn't
stop reading the article. I was just going to glance through it, and I read all 176 pages. It was so fascinating.
Right.
Well, I heard he said he's writing a book on this for people who are interested. So he'll get into all of those details on all of these issues, I'm sure. Do you have any information, Gerard, on how far back Q goes?
Well, he when did he come in? He came in probably around 2014, maybe, first.
Oh.
Well, no, I'm talking about the original. Like, we know that we can trace Q as part of there's a group called Q in the military. We know we trace it all the way back, at least I've heard anyway, to Lincoln's day.
Well, but I only know what you know.
He's been part of the military for quite some time.
Yeah, I don't know how far back they go. They claim it goes back a ways. I don't have any hard and fast anything on that. I just use people like Derek, what Derek says. But it was definitely around in the Civil War, and it was before that. So I don't know how much longer before the Civil War it was around.
Interesting. Okay, very well, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
All right. Are you going to be around at 10? I'll pass the mic over to you.
Yeah, probably.
Okay. All right. Well, let me take the next person.
I got my nebulizer on. I'm very sick, but I'm here.
Okay. Dan, you got the mic. Go right ahead. Dan, are you still there?
Hello?
You got the mic. Last call for Dan. Dan, you got the mic.
Hello, can you hear me?
Okay, yeah. Get a little closer to your mic if you can, but go right ahead. We can hear you. What state are you from, Dan?
Hi, John. I'm from Florida, originally from New York.
Oh, okay.
Cool. I'm not so sure I have, like, so much of a direct question. I guess I just was reading your book, Court Access and the Common Law and Government by Consent. And I actually just graduated law school in New Jersey, and I just found your material really concise and interesting, and just very fresh compared to much of the stuff that I was learning for the past 3 years. So I just wanted to say thank you for that. And yeah, it was much like your book, Court Access, was much clearer than probably 95% of what my professors were trying to teach us. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I know my brother went to law school too, and he never went to practice law, though he ended up doing something else. But he did go to law school, and he mentioned two things about it was interesting. I found interesting. Number one, he said they spent a half hour on the Constitution with him. They spent a lot. The other thing he said is that they really don't teach you too much about the process, okay? And they're really counting on you when you come out of law school to go to work with underneath some other lawyers in order to learn the process, so they can kind of put their arm around you, I presume, and kind of lead you down the right way, so to speak. So that was a couple of things very interesting. It took a while for us to figure out, and we actually really fell into a lucky situation where we had a lawyer that was teaching the process itself, how to go through the discovery and how that whole really process of due process actually works, which starts with the action and, the answers and so on and so forth, and then discovery and all the way up to the trial. So did they teach a lot of details of that to you or no?
No, so yeah, they really just skipped over. I'm actually in a kind of interesting category because I'm the first law school class pretty much in the history to only be taught over Zoom. But we kind of went hybrid the last year and a half. But the first year and a half was all on Zoom, and they started us out with torts, criminal law, contracts, and then con law. But it's so case heavy, it's so case specific, that you just eventually you get lost in their lines of reasoning that just go on forever, and everybody's trying to one up the other and show that they're somehow more prepared, but all that stuff eventually falls down and people just basically break down and get into their real modes of studying and whatnot. But
did they teach you that where our law comes up underneath Roman law?
Absolutely not. I had one professor who's actually a librarian for the school, and I was talking to him about it, and he was, he couldn't care less that I was even interested in the topic. He taught remedies, equitable remedies or whatever, and I can't even remember the class now, but they couldn't care less, and anything that wasn't on the curriculum or wasn't within.
Two things I've heard lawyers say to me numerous times. One is that they claim that we're under Roman law, and that's one thing. Another thing that they claim is that common law is a collection of case law. That's another thing they teach.
That's true. That's one of the first things they said to us was the common law is the case law, which, I bought at first. But then I really, after, changing my perspective a little bit, it's crazy. It's crazy what they compare with.
Absolutely. And matter of fact, we'll be sharing a paper this Saturday, and we'll be focusing in on this very topic. And I'm still working on that paper. I'm hoping to finish it up tomorrow and get it done early so I could do other things, because I've been working on this paper for quite some time. And you know, the way I'm couching it for the case that I'm in, it just took me a long time to figure out how to couch this paper. But in any event, I pretty much am there right now. Well, you know, we have a course, I don't know if you're aware of it, we do have a course that I'm finishing up the last lesson right now. Are you familiar with our course, Court Access in the Common Law course?
No.
Okay, you could find it under Education Starts Here, Court Access in the Common Law course. Let me ask you a question. How much would you say that you had to invest in your education in order to go through law school? Roughly?
Yeah, I mean, not counting, I guess, the opportunity cost, right? Up front, I would say at least, I don't know, 200. I mean, nah, that's probably a little bit high, but at least 150.
Okay, yeah. I'm kind of thinking that about the same thing I've heard from other people, roughly speaking, but $150.
State, and I got a scholarship for half the time, or a little bit more. But it was still, you know, it's such a drain.
Well, we don't teach case law. We teach common law. And I am, you know, again, I'm just finishing up on a course which we did record. For those people who are interested, you can sign up here at Court Access in the Common Law, as I'm showing here on the screen. You just click on that and read through the information. And we even give you access to the first part of the course so that you can get an idea how the course runs. But once you join the course, you'll then get two other tabs. Anybody in the course gets these tabs. And we have court access recorded videos, and then we have the table of contents. Just to give an idea on the court access recorded videos, re-recorded. So anybody who takes the course, it's like taking it live. The only thing is you don't get the Q&A after. I mean, you do hear the Q&A we had during this course. But then you can always come here on a Monday night and ask questions so we can respond to any questions concerning this course. But this is all the videos on the courses here and what we cover. And on the bottom of this page, you know, these are all videos. It's got a lot of information, go through all the paperwork and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we cover a lot of stuff. And then we also have all of these videos in audio. And I know I learned good once you get the first visual. After that, you can just put the audio on, and that helps to really cement it in your brain just by listening to those things or certain parts over and over, or listen to a certain part that if you're in the beginning of your pleadings, or if you're at the point where and then you're building the pleadings, looking for a cause of action and what kind of defenses are available and how to write memorandums and so on and so forth. And then go through the part where, you know, the discovery. And that's also, we also have all of the paperwork that we cover in this course, all of the different forms and everything you need for, you know, to actually go in and build a course. But that's under what's called the table of contents. And on that page, it breaks down every chapter. You know, we start with the introduction to the essentials, and, you know, we cover just a tremendous amount of materials in this, a lot of forms and everything you need to really get into the courts, all the pleadings, information on pleadings, the cause of action, defenses, motions, memorandums of law, rules of common law particularly, and we talk about the federal rules of civil procedure and different things. This chapter here is on the appeals, enforcement, extraordinary writs. And also you can, you know, instead of going for an appeal, you can sue a court directly if you open up a court of record and they violate that. So that's what I'm in the process right now of doing. And we got some case examples, a lot of case examples, how to challenge jurisdictions, all the forms you need, moving for cause. We give a particular case, breakdown of a case for the IRS and the collateral attack upon that court, and then we end up with talking about the sheriff, the jury administrators, and National Liberty Alliance and the committees of safety. Now we've recorded all the way up through 12, but we did skip. Well, I did 11, chapter 11A, and we have a chapter 11B which I'll be teaching next Saturday. And that's going to be an interesting paper. Again, I've been working on that for about well over a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks, and trying to put this together and word it in a good way, in a correct way. So we'll be talking about that. But anyway, this is the only course we really charge for. All of our courses are free, with the exception of a few of them that we ask you to be a premier member in order to get into that course. There's a couple of them. And a premium member is someone who's given $5 a month or more, so pretty much everyone can afford that. But we do allow certain people to come in if they really are that strapped on money and they really want to get in those courses, we'll let them in. But this one here, we charge $125, so it's a lot less than
$150,000.
Yeah. It's unbelievable the amount of money they charge to begin with. And then you really don't learn anything. You're really being poisoned and taught to carry the load of the deep state, because bar attorneys ultimately are the minions of the New World Order. Their purpose, they were founded here in America in colonial days back in 1750, and the purpose was to destroy our judicial system. And, of course, that expanded far more than that, our political system, our religious institutions, all of our institutions. The bar is destroyed at all.
Can I ask you another question?
Sure.
If you were in my shoes and let's say you were, you just finished law school, would you sit for the bar or would you go, go all the way? Or would you, what would you do if you were me?
Well, look, you've got some knowledge of them. Okay, and if you take the pill to get the cure, which is the studying of common law, that's the cure. Then you've got a little bit of an edge over others because you understand a lot more than most people who are coming in without the education that you have. So I wouldn't cast it off as being really that bad. You could become an individual to be a real strong defender of the common law and being able to articulate arguments probably a lot better than most people by knowing what you know and then learning what we're teaching here. I personally would not become a bar attorney. I would not take the exam, but I'm not telling you not to do that. Maybe you have some other ideas, but the main reason I wouldn't do it is just because then you're strapped into their plan. They're coming in civil law. The argument I'm making right now, which I'll be talking in great depth on Saturday about, is the fact that they're under civil law. They're under law that is founded under Rule 2 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And that expands and extends all the way down into town and village courts because it's all working really with civil law. And they've combined... I don't know if you're familiar with this, they claim, and this is another interesting point, because some lawyers believe that they've abrogated the common law, and some lawyers believe that the common law is case law. So you've got two different points of views that I've heard from lawyers. The United States Supreme Court back in 1938, when they wrote the rules, Rule 2, did abrogate the common law from their perspective, in the sense that it created a civil law process in our courts.
Which rule did you just say?
Rule 2. Rule 2.
Of what?
Rule 2 in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Okay.
Okay. And that is interpreted quite clearly on the Supreme Court's website. We do have... let me see if I can just pop that up real quick. Let me see... we should probably have it under rules or maybe memorandums. Let me see here. Well, rules, memorandums, Rule 12, Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Yep, that would be under there. Hang on a second. Rules of the Court, Maxims. Let's see if... basically, we'll look at Rule 2 here, and you'll see how they word it. But then they defined it quite clearly, okay, on their website, on what Rule 2 actually means. And what it does is it combines law and equity and calls it civil law. So they created civil law process. Civil law is Roman.
Rule 2, one form of action. There's one form of action, the civil action.
Right. And they get into more detail of its meaning if you go on to the United States Supreme Court's website. And what you'll find is they talk about the fact that they explain that and said that they have combined equity and law, fused them together, and come in one action. And that's the civil action. Now, that's civil action under Rule 2. Now, we know that it exists, but it's a de facto system. It's administrative. It's an nisi prius court. One agrees to it before enters into it, just like going into the village courts for, when they give you a code violation of driving, you're actually under commercial law and traffic law, traffic violations, and it has nothing to do with me or you. It has to do with those people operating commercially, and so you make your argument, and it's an administrative process, and you have to agree first before you enter into it. That's why they ask for a plea. And they go to headstands or whatever they got to do where people are refusing to give a plea. It's really kind of funny at some point when you watch this stuff, because they really are forcing you to agree. And or the judge will say, I'll put a plea in for you or something, But in any event, so he's practicing law and becoming a lawyer, I guess. But in any event, Rule 2, I've taken the perspective or the position from that kind of a standpoint. They've got a de facto law under Rule 2, but we're coming in under common law, okay, which goes according to the rules of common law. And that's what my argument is that I put together that I'll be sharing this Saturday. I think it's, right now it's 17, maybe 18 pages. So it's part of what we're calling the anatomy of a court case, to teach people how to put a court case together. And the ideas in this particular court case, this was done on the IRS, so the ideas, and on an actual case, and the idea and the layout in this court case is kind of really something that you can lay out any case with. We teach collateral attack upon the court. Instead of appealing, you sue them. And of course, this here, what I'm talking about, this particular, which is really a writ of error. And I probably should have done a writ of error before the collateral attack. But the way it ended up, the way circumstances brought it up, I still am able to really push forward this writ of error first and then come back with the collateral attack. I'll be discussing that on Saturday. But anyway, we're teaching a course that's running people $125, and you're going to learn a lot more. Of course, you're going to learn the real law than $150,000. It's a real ripoff that they charge that kind of money. But being a bar attorney, you go into the court, you could be sanctioned. They'll beat you up pretty bad if you're a bar attorney, and you go off the plantation, so to speak. Me, I go in. I'm not a bar attorney, so hey.
So what would
sanction me? But
What would you do instead of getting the bar? What would you do for work as a lawyer? So just as just
well, you could practice law as a common law lawyer. It's difficult to get that case in and make everyone to acknowledge the fact that this is running pursuant to the common law and not to the rules of men. And again, that's the case I'm going to be making this Saturday to make that point. I don't know where it's going to go. I haven't filed it yet. Again, I'm just finishing up on that paper. It will be filed soon. So I'll be talking about it in detail, and reading through it, So, if I was going to practice law, and to some degree I am, but I'm not really, that's not my plan in life. I got other plans in life, but I had to learn the law in order to do what we're doing here. And so that was my reasoning behind learning the law and being able to go into the court system to try to argue and win back a common law court. And that's been my focus for, goodness, maybe 12, 15 years now. But if I was going to do it as a business, in order, that's what I was going to do for a living, I would do it from the common law perspective. I'd be a common law lawyer, and I'd notify the court as I came in that that's what I am, as a common law lawyer. I'm not a bar attorney, and we're opening up a court of record. which proceeds according to the common law, and then, you know, it's an uphill battle. But I do believe once devolution comes to full play and we get to the other side of devolution, and we've got papers going in before the Supreme Court. We've been battling to get them into the Supreme Court. But it'll eventually get there, and we have 18 points to bring the courts back to courts of record. And as a matter of fact, you can read those papers. They're on our front page. I don't know if you've seen them here. And we do. We put that. I believe we put that in audio too, in video. Let's see. Yeah, click here to read the writ mandamus to the United States Supreme Court. And I do believe we have it on record. Let's see. This is a seminar. Okay, maybe it's on the same page. Let me open that up. You may have the videos here too on the same. Yeah, we do. Okay, so we have. You can read the document. You can click open the document on this page, and read it right here. It's the prerogative writ mandamus to the United States Supreme Court, and then we have 19 videos here where we read through it. So you might want to take a look at that and see once what you think, and maybe we can have some good conversations about it.
Hey, John, I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
All the bar member attorneys that we know of, even if they are common law minded, their conscience has been seared. Yes. I haven't come across a single one whose conscience has been seared. So for Dan here, at what point, John, do you think that happens? Do you think it happens after law school, or does it happen after the bar exam and after you've been initiated, so to speak?
Oh, look, they get people that are 18, 19 years old coming straight out of high school. They've already polluted down there to begin with, and they're coming in and they're believing everything they're told. Every once in a while, you get a person that's a thinker and starts to try to figure things out and starts to see the cracks in the game here, you know.
There's plenty of polluted people that, you know, were corrupt, or you might say, beforehand. And, mm-hmm. you know, being a bar attorney doesn't make you corrupt, but being a corrupt person does.
So right.
You know, they have their – there's those people, like, for example – My school, Rutgers Newark, is the first school in the nation to mandate vaccines. I am in the 1% of all students on campus that did not get vaccinated because I fought like hell. I got a doctor to basically like give me some help, and but I understand what. I'm not sure who that
was. Yeah, the problem is they seduce you over time. And here's the problem. You're carrying the water for the deep state because you're bringing forward civil law where common law should be. They polluted our courts. And I haven't seen a true common law court open up anywhere. And we've been trying for a long time. And I got a paper that should do it, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen. You know, every time I go into court, I've discovered the very same thing. You know, you want to go in there, you want to make your battle against the individuals you're going to battle with. But before you could do anything, you find yourself battling the judge. It's constant. And this is a case, that I've been working on, which is an IRS case, and I've been in court with them before. But anyway, this is an IRS case. And really, it's a case that I've been working on so long, trying to puzzle through their process, their system, their courts, and to understand, how things work on that. And I think I got it pretty well figured out. I see the game they're playing, and using their own codes, I destroy their case. But the thing is trying to prevent yourself from being thrown out under Rule 12. That's the big, big thing. And then they come out after you, telling you that you're frivolous and that you're bringing in all these theories. And I don't rest my case on any of the things that bring forth these theories. I don't argue the fact that the IRS is not a government agency. I don't argue the fact that they're not government agents. I don't argue any of those things. I beat them on their own turf because you know, I discovered the game that they play and went down their rabbit holes. But the other thing is again, getting the common law court open and preventing yourself from being kicked out on Rule 12. That's a big, big problem. And I think I made a case that's going to make it pretty difficult for them to do. But then after that, that's when we'll reapply a collateral attack upon them and if necessary, do an appeal if they are able to cover that up, which they will and they have and they do. They cover those things up and still block you. And they're counting on the fact that you don't know the next step. But we've been through this so many times that every time you come back, you're able to get one more step closer and then another step closer. And so we're figuring out all their game plans.
I get it.
Yeah. And by the way, I just want to make the point, you don't have to be corrupt to have your conscience seared. I mean, there are good people out there, but what they cannot do is they cannot reconcile the difference between what they were taught and the common law. They just can't make it work, like this Kash Patel. And the lady who, her husband's JC, what's her name? She teaches the Constitution. They can't get their head around it. There's always some cross purpose that they come to, and I've never seen a single one that's conscience where the conscience isn't.
It's foundational poison is what it is.
And yeah, exactly. It's foundational poison.
Common law, when coming from the perspective of the common law, one thing you have to really deal with the fact that this is the law of God and that this comes straight from the Bible and that the king of the court is Jesus Christ. And that's a very difficult thing for these people to deal with, or most people anyway. You know, even a lot of people that claim to be Christian, it's still hard to deal with that, especially if you've gone through the law courses that they're teaching, the bar curriculum. But you know, the thing is as time goes on, you find yourself deeper and deeper into situations and problems and realizing, you know, the battles that you've been making is really the battles for the New World Order and not for the people. And again, you are fighting cases for individuals or whatever, of course, but the bottom line is just everything's being buried deeper and deeper and deeper. Case law just just pollutes everything, pollutes it
Chris
all.
Chris Ann Hall, that's who I was trying to think of. By the way, I did pull up the federal rules of civil procedure that merge equity and common law from the Federal Judicial Center. If you wanted to hear the small paragraph, I pulled it up. And I just
read it up.
Okay. And listen to this date. I just noticed this for the first time. September 16th, 1938. You know that September 17th is when the Constitution was ratified, and that's the start of Constitution Week every year, and it's supposed to be taught in the schools. I just noticed that for the first time.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. That's something. And yeah. All right, and then here's the paragraph. In 1938, pursuant to its authority under the Rules Enabling Act of 1934, the Supreme Court enacted uniform rules of procedure for the federal courts. Among the changes wrought by the rules was the elimination of the federal court's separate jurisdiction over suits in equity, a centuries-old system of English jurisprudence in which judges based decisions on general principles of fairness in situations where rigid application of common law rules would have brought about injustice.
Isn't that interesting? God's will bring back injustice. So go ahead, finish here.
Sorry, that's my bulldog. Under the new rules, suits in equity and suits at common law were grouped together under the term civil action, and that's the whole paragraph. And I do want to make the point that if you know the New World Order's, if you know their doctrine, and it's Babylonian civil law, if you know their doctrine, it is unfair to them, the common law. The common law is unfair to them because they see us as cattle, and when they can't just up and steal a widow's house, that's unfair to them. So anyway, it does make sense if you put it into context, but anyway, the common law is the fairest law.
Exactly. It destroys the New World Order process. It destroys all the things that they're doing. But again, getting back to lawyers, as time goes on, I think they become more and more problematic in their thinking and more fixed into it. And again, you know, the key thing is that common law is based on Christianity, period. But the civil law is based on men and ultimately finds its beginnings. And as you trace it, you know, a lot of lawyers say Roman law. And I read a lot of that on the internet when I was doing research. Oh, who is talking? The United States is under Roman law. But Roman law is Justinian law, which is just repackaged Babylonian law. And that's the chain. It goes from Roman law, Justinian law, Babylonian law, which is the law of the city, municipality law. To control the slaves, keep them in, under bondage. So they built all of these statutory prisons for us, and they keep us busy in these statutory prisons as they continue to destroy America. But anyway, we should move to our next caller, Dan, and good talking, and take a look at some of these things, and let's have some conversations. It'd be interesting to get some of your insight from your perspective.
Sure. You guys do a call every Monday, and you do it on Saturday as well, you said?
Well, we have a call every Monday from 9 p.m. to 11 on Eastern Standard Time. And you said you're Florida, so you're on a time zone. We've been doing a Saturday morning course. Actually starts at noon. It's not morning, afternoon. It usually goes about 4 hours. And the last one we did went 5 hours, so, but usually goes 4 hours. And we have one more left, and we're done. We won't be doing any more Saturdays. I've been thinking if I can get back to it. There's other things I'd like to teach, but I'll see what happens in the future.
Gotcha. John, would it be possible to get your contact information somehow and speak with you another time?
Sure. Send an email requesting that mail, mail, at nationallibertyalliance.org. I'll keep an eye out for it. All of our leadership gets gets that particular mail, so we all get to read whatever comes in it. But send it there, and I'll keep an eye out for it, and I'll respond back to you with my phone number.
All right. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. All right. Okay, take our next caller. Hey, Gerard, are you ready to take the mic?
Yeah, sure.
Gerard?
Yeah. I'm here.
Doesn't even sound like you.
I'm sorry.
You mentioned something, you were on a nebulizer or something?
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, you don't even sound like you.
Well, I'm incognito today.
Okay.
This thing ran through the house, the whole house. It has like a 3-day incubation period. Everybody got it. One, the next. Every 3 days. Horrible. But anyway.
Okay, I'll hit the button for you, then you can pick it up from there. The next caller is coming in. It's Marianne. You got the mic. You got it. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Marianne, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Gerard. And John. I'm just calling to find out, because I know on the website there are a list of federal cases that were filed, and I was wondering, is there any way to gain access to see any of the traffic court cases that John had done?
I don't know that we have any traffic court cases that we publish.
Okay, so nothing published.
Well, we do have. You're in the course, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, as far as.
Yeah, no, I mean, Marianne, you're in the course, aren't you?
Yes, I'm in the course.
All right. Well, if you go here, let's see. Education starts here. Go to the page where we have the table of contents. Okay. And if you click on the table of contents and you come down to cases, which we did on 11, chapter 11. Here is a, let's see, instructions, yeah, traffic court argument and the challenge. This jurisdictional challenge is the traffic court, and it's really on any kind of a code violation. You use it on any one of them. All you do is just take the case and put it into, the framework of this jurisdictional challenge. Because what you want to do is challenge the jurisdiction, because they don't have personam jurisdiction. They might have, they do have subject matter jurisdiction, but that has nothing to do with you. That has to do with commercial activities. So that would be a place where you find it. And I also have a traffic court argument, okay, which again you could deal with as used as the codes. It doesn't matter what code, it could be other things, you know, that they come out after you on these village courts and the town courts. And not that you want to make the arguments, all these arguments, but it's just a lot of different information that you might have with you, and you might be able to respond with something and maybe, you know, take out of this argument that I put together different things. So let me just open it up for, you know, for instance here, you, one of the things you do want to say when you go into those courts that you're here for, by special appearance and for the purpose of testing the sufficiency of the service or the jurisdiction of the court. Okay, that's exactly what you might say. Now, you're not going to read all this stuff up, and you're not going to cover all this stuff up, but if it comes up, you can deal with it, you know? But, you know, as far as going through a traffic court, again, this is it. I mean, there isn't. I would do the same thing every time. Last time I went to traffic court, you know, I ended up with the bottom line, we're going to go to federal court. I'm not coming back here no more. And they did let me go. You know, they threw the case out. So, you know, I don't know how often it works, but hey, you know, half the time I usually send a paper to court. So over the years, I send a paper into the court, and half the time I never hear back from the court. The other half, I got to go in and waste my time. I end up just paying the ticket and leaving because I ain't got the time. But now I'm doing the battle.
Yeah, because I'm ready to. I'm just done. I'm so done because between Illinois and Indiana, there's the toll roads, and I have been driving without one of those things, iPass, ePass, whatever, EasyPass. They call it EasyPass out there in New York. I've been driving without one of those, and I just drive, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I get a bill in the mail because what they do. I mean, this is where we the people really need to come back because they take a picture of my license plate, and then somehow magically yada yada yada, they're able to track me down like a dog.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a problem with that, and so the only thing is they send me a bill, and then just say, "Oh, this is how you pay it." I'm like, well,
yeah,
I'm not paying it.
It's amazing, isn't it?
I'm not paying it. Just because, I mean,
well, you got to be careful. You got to be careful because, again, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than ignorance in action, and they got the gun. So you want to do something and deal with these people. I wouldn't let anything hang because eventually they'll get rid of your license. They'll, you know, take your license away from you. And then eventually you might get stopped and not have a license. And next thing you know, you're sitting in jail because, again, they don't have the power and the authority to do this. But they do have the power, I guess. They just don't have the authority. And because they got the guns, and ignorance is dangerous stuff.
So how do I...
You have to fight each battle. What I do is I write a paper and send it in. And the paper I write, I share that on that jurisdictional challenge. That's the paper I write. I send it into court, and I make sure, if I send a paper in and my court date is in less than 30 days... I'll send it in, I'll send a copy to the prosecutor, and then I'll call the court 2 weeks before the court case and say, hey, look, I'm looking at my schedule, I'm kind of tied up, can I push the court date to another, they'll give it to you, they don't care, they're fine with that, they just want you to come in and give them your money. So you'll get that pushover, okay? So the thing is they won't answer your paper, the clerk will send the paper back, okay, and you go into court with the paper. And you make the point that, hey, you sent it, and I usually follow up with a default after 30 days. I default the prosecutor because he doesn't respond. Now, they ignore all that, but one of the things that shakes them up, I know it shook them up when I was in court with this last one I went to, what really shakes them up is not only to let it know, hey, I'm here by special appearance, I'm here to test the jurisdiction of the court, and by the way, I sent in a paper, and your clerk sent it back, and they violated a law. That's a felony, and 2 years in jail. And you read off the code to them, it shakes them up, because they have no idea about that to begin with. They're not permitted to take papers out of the court when it's filed. You know, the clerk is obligated to file it, and no one can take that paper out of the court. They do it all the time. So that's one thing that you use to shake them up. you sent the paper in, and you say, hey, look, we've got the paper right here. And here's the proof that it went in, and the proof, you know, I have a certificate of service also, and I also have, with the court, I have a, you know, the green card with the signature. And if they got the stamp on it, that's good, too. I don't remember what they had to stamp on this one. But I showed the paper with everything. I said, this is what they sent back. And I give the judge doesn't have a copy of my papers, so I give him a copy. Prosecutor doesn't have a copy of my papers, I give them a copy. And because they should, they claim they don't. They never seen it. And they get to talk a little bit, and in this case, they threw me out of the court.
Okay.
Which I was happy to do, to leave, you know.
Okay, right, because I'm looking at the, like, they just send a bill, and they just say, yeah. Oh, go, just, here's how you pay it.
No, that's where they're at this point. You have the right.
There's no way to fight it. Like, they just send a bill.
Look, on that bill, there has to be a paper to be traced back to the court. And that's all you have to do is trace it back to the court and send a paper and send a paper into the court denying jurisdiction. And now you're going to have to go in for a hearing, though. You know.
Oh, to me, I'm done. I think it's time to take it all on. Mm-hmm. I think I'm not here to choose battles. I'm here to fight them all. And
Well, traffic court is a good place to learn how to deal with a court. It's good, you know, it's good practice.
Okay, so it says, dispute an unpaid toll. To dispute an image or unpaid toll, you may submit an affidavit of non-liability available while reviewing your invoices.
Hey, look, you know, can you email, attach that to an email and send it to mail@nationallibertyalliance.org and just make a note that, you know, this is a paper I wanted to look at. I'd like to see that.
Oh, yeah, it was due July 27th.
Mm-hmm.
I just, like, whatever.
Well, look, don't ignore the government because, again, there's nothing more dangerous than ignorant inaction, especially courts. You know, you don't want to ignore them. And the IRS, you don't want to ignore them either. You want to respond to everything. So.
So email it to where again?
Email it to mail@nationallibertyalliance.org, and just make a note in the subject. You know. That this is what is it? It's a it's just a bill. What is it called?
Invoice for missed toll.
Okay, so just put that in the subject line. So I'll see that and pick up on it.
Yeah, and I have it for both. I have one for Indiana. Looks like there's one for Indiana and one for Illinois because what they did was they grouped it under IPAS.
Uh-huh. Yeah, send them both if you can. Copy them both and send. I'd love to see these.
I'm just so done.
Yeah, me too.
I have to pay it. And I will also tell you that if I go into the Indiana, the toll roads,
mm-hmm.
It's under FFA.gov or something. They are also not only the same Indiana Tollway whatever funding agency, investment agency, also has a neurodiagnostic institute in Indianapolis. Like, okay, so they have a toll road and a neurodiagnostic institute in Indianapolis. Like, it just, like, what in the world? And then they're also installing, and you may, magnetic roads or something here. They want to be able to charge an electric vehicle while you're driving it.
Hmm.
These people are crazy.
Well, yeah, and electric is more disruptive ultimately to the environment when you consider the batteries that they're using. and they're dangerous. And that thing goes on fire, they can't even put that fire out. You know, they're pretty dangerous from what I'm seeing.
Yeah.
And the amount of electricity it takes, you know, I mean, where are they getting all this electricity from? How are they creating all this electricity? And, I mean, it's just so stupid. It's pathetic. And batteries are dangerous, you know. I know there's, what's his name, Bob Lazar, and I'm sure a lot of people heard of him. And he's been driving, he said, for 10 years now on water. He literally drives on water, and, you know, which is really... the hydrogen is used driving on, and he patented it, and I think to retrofit your car for this, he says about, I think he said about $4,000, and the thing about it, he says, you know, you charge your at home, you create this tube of, I guess, hydrogen, and it must be in a safe way, you know, because pure hydrogen is pretty explosive. And however that all works. You know, he creates this tube that he'll put into the car, and it'll take him 700 miles, he says. And he says, you know, but it also still takes gas. So, you know, if you run out and you're on the road, you can put gas in the car and drive it home. So it's kind of amazing. I just heard about that. He was talking on an interview just recently, I heard.
And, John, you know how many of the guys they killed?
Huh?
You know how many of the guys they've killed already?
I know. I'm surprised they didn't take out Bob Lazar.
Well, it's going to come out.
I don't think he's really selling it, but he did patent it. He said, and he drives it like that. But he says it costs about $3,000 or $4,000 to retrofit your car for it and set up what you need at home in order to produce the necessary fuel. However, all that works. I'd love to know how it works. Yeah. But anyway, back to you, Gerard. You got the mic, by the way. Back
yeah.
To you.
I was going to say, you talked about don't ignore them, and yeah, traffic court is a good place to practice, but they play games too, and if the judge orders you to do something and you don't do it, he can hold you in contempt, and you can end up in jail over a traffic ticket for the judge holding you in contempt, you know, and they got sneaky ways of doing that too, so you got to be careful. And the other funny thing, you know, we mentioned Chris Ann Hall, and she doesn't like, he said, common law. Well, Chris Ann Hall will not go into federal court. She's scared of it. Most lawyers seem to have this big fear of federal court for some reason.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
I don't know what kind of control they have over them, but there's a big fear.
I think you were with me on the time we went in, and even though the judge was against me in many ways, but he beat up the all those lawyers coming in. I'm sure you were with me. Tony was
there. Yeah, I was there. I saw it. Yeah. And even
I think they enjoyed doing that, beating up these lawyers coming in from the
Well, they had some screw ups that they shouldn't have had. And you were up there saying what you were saying, and he was like embarrassed that they did not do a better job. I think.
Maybe, yeah.
You know what I mean?
They didn't do that Rule 12 to throw me out. Well, let me think about this. Yeah, they didn't do it because I sued them. The IRS. So, yeah, they didn't do that Rule 12 to throw me out. That was interesting.
But it's funny, like, Chris Ann Hall doesn't believe that anybody should ever go into federal court because she thinks they'll chew you up and spit you out. And that may be true if you don't know what you're doing.
There's a myriad of jurisdictions. I mean, right off the bat, you got 57 codes, so that's 57 jurisdictions.
That's
part of my argument right now. They refuse to come to the jurisdiction that they hijacked me into. Okay? So, and that's what we'll be talking about on Saturday. One lawyer, the U.S. attorney seems to think we're under U.S. C-26. The other ones just seem to think we're under some kind of a civil law, and they're all state people. They're all state lawyers coming into the federal court. And the judge refuses to answer, again, what jurisdiction I've been hijacked into. I opened up a court of record, as being the plaintiff, and being sued, I have the ability to choose the jurisdiction. My jurisdiction I chose was the court of record and not civil law operating under Rule 2, but law that operates under the Constitution. And that's my argument. And I think I put it together a pretty good argument. I mean, I've been battling this for a long time and puzzling it through for a long time.
Yeah, that's when the judge says, we'll have no Constitution in here. But
yep.
Anyway.
I'm sorry. You're so
are we done?
I
having a hard time hearing her. Go ahead.
Yeah. Low all of a sudden.
That's because I have my speaker plugged in.
Oh. Yeah, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
So my
John's blasting me, and I turn it up for you, and my wife is going crazy. Why you got it so loud? Because I can't hear the other person.
Sorry. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Marianne.
Okay.
See you on Saturday.
Next question. It didn't go. Why isn't it going? There we go.
Hey, John. Did you watch the video I sent to you about the gateway to the Republic?
I might have. I don't. Tell me a little bit about the video so it'll spark my brain up a little bit.
It's about opening a personal account or a business account to be the way to, that's another way you can sue public officials through the postal service.
Oh, yeah, no, I haven't seen that video. I don't know. Jan, did you see that an email coming in through mail for with a video on it? I didn't see that. I might have got something and went to a website and didn't know or realize there was a video there. That's a problem.
It's a YouTube video.
Well, what are the keywords that I could put into YouTube?
Oh, it's Gateway to the Republic.
All right, let me put that in. To the Republic. There it is. Okay, is this it here? Gateway to the Republic, this one?
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, everyone. It's Rob Ryder.
Okay, Rob Ryder. He sounds familiar. Do we know Rob Ryder?
Yes, we do. From way, way back.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I'll take a look at this during the week. Okay? I'll leave it in my place here to get back to.
Excuse me.
And because also he talks about claiming your name before they do, is about the business registration certificate and the application of registration of your fictitious name.
Well, you know, if I recall, you know. We've heard of this guy before. We've looked somewhat into it. I don't remember the details. I'm going to watch the video, and I'm sure my memory will be sparked up of some of the things. But I shy away from a lot of different things that people share and doing this and doing that. And, you know, before I do anything, I want to get some good research, or I want to learn from somebody that's done the good research and that I can hear them talk about it and realize they did do the research. And then maybe I...
Oh, he did do the research.
I know he has, but sometimes people do things that they probably shouldn't do, or I don't know. I'll have to look in. I don't want to. But the name is familiar, and I don't think we ever adopted any of his stuff, did we, Gerard? I don't recall.
Well, he had a couple of good papers that we were maybe base some of our stuff on. I mean, you know, he's got some good arguments, but... He kind of gets into that man on the land type stuff where you're, you know, register your name before they get it. And it makes sense. It definitely makes sense. But it's like you coming in there and telling them that you don't need a license to drive a car. They're going to look at you like you got three heads.
Right. When I go into court, especially federal court, I'm not making any argument against the system. I just tell it the way it is and try to put it in, couch it in such a way as to make the difference between the two things. But I never go in and say, for instance, I mean, I have done it, don't get me wrong, but I don't do it anymore. Because once you start making the argument that the IRS, for instance, isn't a government agency, you know, you just polluted your whole case, and you're stuck on that argument now. But why not get to the case? Let's get to the nitty-gritty. Let's get to the facts of the case. You know? And you can win on the facts. That's the key. And again, you know, we did on our course, and I know you're in the course, Ross. I mean, on the course, we did discuss
Well, you know, Rob Ryder, I think he gets involved in their system. Like, he tries to use their system against them. Mm-hmm. And if you really know their system, you can do that. But generally speaking, if you're trying to preserve your jurisdiction, you don't want to enter into their system. I think that was the problem we had with him. Don't hold me to that. But John,
he does that, and he uses a system. He uses a special data against the Sister Kitty administration to correct the record.
When you use their system against them, you might win one time. And then they turn around and they change the rules. As soon as that happens, they change the rules. That was like that IRS agent, Joe Bannister. You know, he won, but you can't use his defense because they've already closed that hole because they knew that it was a problem. So they changed the law and they made a different, you know.
Congress will probably change the law.
Yeah. And anyway, don't hold me to it, but I think that's the problem we had with him, that we didn't want to enter into their system to beat their system because, and you can do that. That's fine. But you open yourself up to all the other crap that's in their system, which you may not know about, and they'll throw at you, and then you're standing there with your tongue hanging out, with your jaw down.
Yes, okay. See, they have a lot of defects in the record, too. And he talks about correcting the errors they have in there. So when they change the rules, they don't want to change the record.
Right.
That's the problem. They're getting around what you are trying to do is correct the record. So they interpret the way they wanted to interpret the rules.
That's right. If you get a judge, you know, if the judge doesn't go for it, you're sunk, you know? That's the problem we have to, that's where we're at now. We got to get rid of these.
That's where the big argument is, and the difference between the different courts, the court that you open and the court that you're in, and trying to get them to identify on the record what court you're in. And the judges don't seem, and matter of fact, I let the judge know that he's not the judge in this case. You know, we called him a judge in the beginning as far as not when we changed that around. We called him a magistrate. So we have a magistrate, and every time I mentioned him, I don't call him judge something or other. I call him magistrate something or other. And but I do make the case on the reasoning why I call him a magistrate, because this is the court of the people to be that's the tribunal. He's not the tribunal. You know, summary judgments are permitted in a common law court, and I make that case. Of course, they choke on that. Okay, and again, it's an uphill battle. But
have they ever corrected you, John, and say, no, I'm the judge? Have they ever done that?
No, they haven't.
No, because they're afraid to, right?
Yeah, well, they can't. Well, look, it doesn't matter what they do, because the bottom line, you end up with a collateral attack upon them, and if they block that collateral attack, then you do it through an appeal. And you continue that collateral attack after you get through your appeal, because your appeal is really to force the judge to obey the law. And then, of course, that judge is then removed because it's a conflict of interest, not because they became part of the case. You're suing them, too, all the officers in the court. So you're suing the U.S. attorney, you're suing the judge and any other state attorneys or any attorneys that come in there. You're suing them all together because they're all the officers of the court, and it's a collateral attack upon the court. So they're all gone. They can no longer represent the people that they were representing, and the judge can no longer sit in the seat that he was sitting in. And then you get the next judge will come in, and you will be straightened out in the fact that he's the magistrate, and you will see what he does. But you see, you may have to go through the actual appeal system to get there. And I think the environment is right for the appeal. We may not win on an appeal, but I think it is a prime case to get to the United States Supreme Court. I do think that is the case. And as a matter of fact, I'll be talking with Robert Schultz, founder of We the People. He's been before the Supreme Court on a couple of occasions, but I want to discuss some strategies with him to make sure that couched in such such a way that we do get before the Supreme Court if we have to go that route. They're going to fight us tooth and nail. There's no doubt in my mind.
Did you get any money yet from the trust yet you applied to?
Well, if I did, you'd know about it.
Yes.
We'd go professional. In the blink of an eye, we'd go professional and be hiring people and move towards critical mass pretty quickly. You know, we are in the position to go critical mass. Up until recently, we haven't been. Okay, but now we are couched for it. Our website is ready for it. Everything, all the work we need to do preliminarily is ready for it. So critical mass is something we can handle, but we got to get to it. And that requires a lot of people putting a lot of time to do a lot of different things and get a lot of interviews going to get the message out and put critical mass.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ross. Next caller. Looks like Kathy, IA, Indiana. Or is that a repeat?
Hi. Are you talking to Kathy in Minnesota?
This is Kathy, IA.
Hi.
Well, I'm talking to you because that's who came on. So yeah.
I got more of an update than a question. I do have one question, but there's supposed to be a hearing today in the Kangaroo Probate Court in Minnesota, and I don't have an attorney yet, so I didn't want to attend the hearing. So I got somebody at National Liberty Alliance was kind enough to help me draft the motion for continuance, and it apparently worked. I didn't want to go in and file it myself because I've got a fraudulent warrant against me on a different traffic issue. So I sent two friends in to file it, and they were successful. And they filed it about 8 o'clock or a little after, quarter after 8, but the hearing started at 8:30, so... they apparently told my friends, the clerk of court told my friends that I was still expected to be at the hearing. And, but when I logged into the case tonight, just before the call started here, there was also, besides the hearing today, there was supposed to be hearing on August 2nd and August 3rd, but the hearing is on August 2nd and August 3rd, no longer show up on the docket. There's a hearing on the 24th, I think, and let me see here. But there's a hearing on the 29th and some motion thing on the 24th. So it apparently worked and got a reprieve, so now I've got about a month to get an attorney. So that's...
You need to use this time to do something. And I told you there are two possibilities here. The most strongest possibility in my mind and thinking, and again, you got to puzzle through this, and you need to know what the jurisdiction of that court is. But the key thing is this, is you got to challenge the document and come up with a different document. And I got to believe you take that into the state court for that.
I think you're – I think you're wrong, but – we filed probate in Iowa. My husband lived in Iowa. He had a will in Iowa. Iowa is where this should be happening.
Forget about probate. You don't want to be in that court. You want to go to the state court. You want to argue the document. You have a will, okay, that's newer than the other will. And they're applying this will in probate court in order to steal the estate. And here's the real will. And that's the argument. And you go to court to argue that. The other court's got to stop.
Okay, so you're still saying...
Continue to get your...
I go into federal court.
Get into state court. Not probate.
Okay, but when you're saying state, it would be Iowa state, not Minnesota state. He fled from Minnesota because of this abuse and financial exploitation. So my husband resided in Iowa.
Okay.
So I would go to Iowa.
If you're going to go to Iowa to make the argument, is that what you want to do?
Yes, that's what I want to do.
Then you need to go to the federal court because it's two individuals in two different states. So you go to federal court challenging the document that they're using, fraudulently using, in order to steal the estate. I mean, you've got to be careful on how you word that, but then, you know, that's where you go. Once you can win that, then that other court becomes null and void, and whatever decisions they made, and whatever money they spent, they got to bring it back, and so on and so forth. But first, you've got to prove the document.
There shouldn't be any question that the document is valid because the Howard County attorney was the one that witnessed it, signed his name on it.
Fine, that's your argument. Go into court and make the argument. But again, you got 24 days, roughly speaking, to deal with your problem and file a paper. And that means you got to get diligent in your education, and you have to really focus in on the plan. And you're going into federal court, and you got to remember federal court is limited jurisdiction, and they can hear a case between two individuals from different states. I'm pretty sure that there was no amendment to that. I don't know. That's another thing, because I know they have made some amendments to some things, and you got to make sure that is the case. If you file it in Iowa, it doesn't necessarily have to be done in Iowa. The will was made in Iowa. That doesn't make you could do it in the state that they're in. But if you did it in Iowa, I don't think there's any way that the state court can get jurisdiction in from people in another state. I'm sure you got to go to federal court for that. So do some research on that. That's the strongest, because you don't have to argue anything else. Just that the fact that this is the real will. And you don't have to go
Hold on.
At that point, you don't have to go to probate court in order to deal with the problem, because there's nothing to be questioned. You know, that's it. You take it into the state court and finish the case. Well, actually, you got to finish it in federal court. I'm sorry, because those people are in another state. So that's it. That's where you got to go, I think. That's where I would go.
Why couldn't I hire... I know about bar attorneys, but since this is out of my area of expertise...
You can hire an attorney. But you want to get an attorney that understands... Look, we were just talking about lawyers in federal court. You're going to talk to an attorney that doesn't work in the federal court, and they don't understand. I've seen attorneys... Look, I have seen attorneys who've been to school, okay? They've learned the law, supposedly, okay? And I've seen attorneys go to federal court and file papers, and they got thrown out in an instant, because they're doing things and saying things that don't belong in the federal court. It was the wrong jurisdiction, or the wrong venue, is what I'm saying. Okay, so again, you have to have a lawyer that is willing to go into the federal court and understands how the federal court system works, which is not a difficult thing to learn. I mean, you know, again, you just take a look at the rules and you can figure that out if they're a lawyer. But the thing is, I think in this case, it's a simple case. It's one document over another document. Let them, you got a document that's at a later date than their document, and that rules. They got to prove that that's fraudulent or something, and they can't do that. It's done, period.
So what is the advantage of going into federal court versus state court?
Venue. You have to be in a proper venue. The state, if you go to the state court in one state to sue someone in another state, that state court doesn't have jurisdiction over the individual in the other state. The only exception to that would be a crime.
Following all this.
Constitution says it gives the power to the United States Supreme Court to make judgments between two people in two different states.
Okay. So that's the advantage.
You can open a court of law in there, which they don't understand. They still run and operate as a case law, but you don't care at this point because it's really a document argument, and your lawyer should be able to beat it. Unless they can prove something fugazi about it, you're going to win.
And then what you were saying on Saturday was this wouldn't be a jury trial.
What's the that is not necessary.
Okay. So
it's a matter of a document.
The latest will stands unless they can prove that there's something wrong with his will in Iowa, correct?
They may try to make an argument for that, but they got to prove it.
Okay.
That's number one. The other advantage to this is the lawyers, if they get a lawyer and the lawyer's from the other side, they'll probably bring a person who's from the state level, which has a problem in the federal courts. We were talking about that a little bit. So again, you got to get the right lawyer to do this for you. So you got to talk to a lawyer and really make the point that you understand that this has got to be done in a federal court because it's between two people from two different states. If it's an argument on the paper, can you handle that? Do you understand it? You got to ask this lawyer, do you understand how the jurisdiction, how the process works on the federal level is, and it's pretty much the same anyway, It's just, I think it's really a lot of fear from lawyers, as Gerard had mentioned. I think that's what it is. So,
okay.
But that I think is probably your best bet. I mean, you don't have to fight anything else other than just prove the document is being a document. They got to prove it's not. End of subject. Case over.
Okay, and then back to that traffic ticket that never happened. So I should, now that I have time to breathe, you told me that I should talk to the prosecuting attorney, him I want to see the signed affidavit, correct?
You don't even have, well, look, you could do that. Let me think about this. You could do that, but you can also get a hearing if you want, and that's a real easy one. If you call the clerk, they'll give it to you. They really don't want to go through changes and everything, But, I guess that would be the way to go to get to some kind of documentation.
And they absolutely would have to have a signed affidavit. If they don't have a signed affidavit, I tell them to dismiss this charge against me. Correct?
Well, they're not going to listen to that. You'd have to go into court and make that argument. You could do that by paper, maybe. But again, they got to have some kind of proof on it, and that's that. I don't know what else to tell you on that. I mean, I would think the worst case scenario is you got to report it to your insurance company and cover it, and your insurance company has to cover the damage, I would imagine. But again, you shouldn't have left that unanswered because that becomes a problem. Anyway.
There's been several hearings that... It was never a question of whether I had insurance. It was a question that they claimed that I left the scene of an accident. I didn't leave the scene of an accident.
Okay, well, that's your point. You got to call up and see what's going on with that. I don't know. Look, every case is unique in its own way. Things are similar to some degree, of course, but every case is unique in its own way, and you have to puzzle through things. You have to look at certain things. I told you this. You have to look at the court.
In the meantime, I don't want this warrant to be against me. I was already arrested.
Go call the prosecutor
on the same issue.
What's going on? Or call the court, and why don't you call the court clerk and find out the status of that case?
I've already called my public defender, who has explained to me that if it's a misdemeanor, less than $300 bail, I already paid $200 bail on October when I was arrested for the same thing.
And then you jumped bail?
No, I missed the hearing. I simply missed the hearing on June 12th. So then they put a warrant out for my arrest.
That's the point. And as far as they're concerned, you jumped bail. I don't know.
Okay. Again,
there's a lot of things going on here, and you have to think it out, puzzle it out, and see what kind of strategy can work out. And see if you get another hearing going. And I don't know. You know, again, I tell people all the time, don't ignore the government. Don't ignore the courts because...
I'm not ignoring them, but they want me to go down there and sit all day until I can meet with a judge. I don't have the time to sit there, and I'm dealing with much more important things to do. Fine. This whole thing is bogus.
I'm just trying to tell you, you know, the situation. There's nothing more dangerous than ignorance and actions. Like you said, there's a warrant out for your arrest. That's a problem.
So you're telling me that the only way to deal with it is to jump through their hoops and go down there and sit there all day and meet with a judge?
I'm not telling you to do anything. I'm telling you you have to figure out what to do. Maybe making a phone call to the clerk, find out the status of the case, find out, maybe you get the number for the prosecutor, give him a call and find out what the deal is, what's going on. Tell him your story and see what kind of you can work out. I mean, I wouldn't tell you to just go down there. They may just throw the handcuffs on you and not even...
Well, I know.
Because you jumped it. Since you jumped bail, from their perspective, you know, they're not going to give you bail again.
Well, right. That's the only option they're giving me.
Nothing else I can tell you other than it starts with a phone call, a couple of phone calls.
Figuring okay.
What's going
all
on?
Right.
And what's possible to be done. Prosecutor could tell you what's possible to be done. If you tell the prosecutor
okay, thanks.
And they believe your story and they feel for you, they'll say, okay, look, we'll just set another court date, you know, make sure you're blah, 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 whatever. See what you can do. Mark and
all right, thank you.
Right.
I appreciate it.
Right.
Thanks, bye-bye.
Okay, really quick, we only got a few minutes. We got Linda's had her hand up forever. Let me go. Next question. Okay, Linda, you're on. Hopefully you're still there.
I am still here. Can you hear me?
I can.
I'm Linda, and I'm from Alaska.
Okay.
And I see we only have a few minutes here.
We don't get many people from Alaska. Wow, okay.
Well, you got one now. I signed up for your course about a month ago, and I'm, you know, powering through it, at least the first watch. I think I'm up to memorandums, part B or something now. But anyways, I've got a situation here back in 2019, and I feel like, you know, this might be a... Anyways, I won't even go there. I had purchased from another individual... a promissory note to pay off my mortgage. Went through all of the hoops, got the bank to sign it and receive it and all of that kind of stuff, and then they turned it back and said it was whatever. They weren't going to honor it, and so the next step was to take them to court.
Go back to the promissory note. You said you purchased a promissory note?
Yes.
Explain that a little.
Well, this is kind of where you feel foolish, you know. I mean, I've been.
Has to do with the Seskew accounts?
I don't think so. Like I said, this is back in 2019. Seskew accounts. It might be. I'll have to look at the promissory note. I can't seem to find my document.
Purchasing the promissory note. What was the value and what did you pay for it? A little information on that. I think I know what you're talking about, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I can't even remember the guy's name right now. But anyways, I paid $5,000 for it, and it was a promissory note to pay off like $192,000 left on my mortgage. And he had a whole documented.
What was this person teaching or selling on the internet? What was going on? The one who got you the promissory note. Is he doing things?
Basically getting promissory notes to pay off debts.
Okay. Yeah, look, at that whole thing, I don't want to say it's a scam in a sense because, look, if there is such thing as a Seskew account, they won't admit it. They won't allow you to touch it. There was a deal made. They do deal with us as chattel, livestock. And mortgages really is something that is removed from the Fed window. There's no contract there. The bank that sets the whole system up, the whole thing is a fraud. They may earn a point or half a point on it.
Mm-hmm.
To run the loan through and go to the Fed window, so to speak, in theory, kind of speak. And, you know, it's all digital transfers. and then it's transferred through to you. Then they'll send you a book and tell you you got to pay every month, and they give a piece of that back into the Fed, you know, to the Federal Reserve. When in fact there is no contract, there is nothing. It doesn't exist, and that's why, in order for them to do a foreclosure, they have to go through a process called a non-judicial foreclosure, and the crime is in the name right there. And that becomes your argument in court. Now, if you go to court, they usually handle this in town courts or maybe even a county court. But the bottom line is, as long as you keep going to court, you keep that thing alive. And the court is really not in session. It's never recorded. There's no real decision. While you're going through that process, they're working in the background with robo-signing and transferring your property and going through a whole bunch of crimes, and then it just goes on and on and on. I wrote a paper on this. Let me think about this. It's in the course somewhere. I'm sure we have it in there. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I know we do. We have it in a memorandum on foreclosures. So if you go in and you look, go to the memorandums and look down the memorandums for non-judicial foreclosure, open it up, and you'll see how the whole fraud works. Now, that guy just scammed you in a sense that... there are people out there doing this, and
I actually tried to, I watched and looked at his stuff for a while, and it wasn't until he finally at one point put like a money back guarantee on it. Like, okay, well, if that's the case, I can at least give it a try. But then when you get the paperwork, it's like, well, you get the money back guarantee if you jump through all of these hoops and you do it exactly how I did and whatever, and the court document papers that come with it to take it to court was just a bunch of mumbo jumbo stuff. But I did try to take it to court, and I had, I did take it to court. It wasn't a jury court. And basically there was an order against me that it was whatever. I can't find my paperwork right now. I'm still looking for it. And so recently I've gotten in the mail...
What did you take it to? You took it to a state court?
Yes.
And you sued him?
The bank.
The bank. You should have sued him, but okay. Yeah, the bank isn't going to apply to that. The court's not going to enforce it. You're not going to get anywhere there. They won't even acknowledge the SESQ accounts.
Yeah, I don't know that it was. It's something about, going to the Treasury and getting your I don't understand all of it right now. Again, like I said, it was 4 years ago.
Okay,
but there was a judgment that said basically that I have to, pay their lawyer's fees and all of that kind of stuff for in the amount of $20,000. And they recently, and I never, when the order came out, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know to take it to... appeal or anything like that. So for the past 4 years, it's just been kind of sitting there. And recently I've just gotten a notice of garnishment, and they're wanting to garnish any wages that I have or that I could file this paper for a right to exemptions. So I went ahead and filed that on Friday, the right to exemptions. But according to their civil document that they've got out here, after I claim my exemptions, the court the creditor has 10 days to respond, then there could be a hearing ordered on.
There's really nothing you're going to be able to do with that situation. You need to go after the person who sold you and sue that person.
That means they already got a judgment against you, a default judgment.
Right.
And you're not going to be able to get back into the court on that because you got to deal. Well, see, here's the problem. You have to have a reasonably good education to do this. But there is a way to deal with the problem is the fact that it was a court has and there's no jurisdiction over you because they opened a civil law court and you never agreed to it. It's a nisi prius court. You have to agree first. And then you can countersue them through a court of record. But again, not necessarily that it'll work on this side of devolution. That's a major problem because, again, you're going up against the status quo. You're going up against lawyers, and the court is full of lawyers being decided by a judge, lawyer being decided by lawyers in the court. So it's an uphill battle. You're going to battle with the judge first, because you want to change the jurisdiction over to a proper jurisdiction, and so on. And this was just you filed the papers and you didn't go in, or you did make the argument, or what?
Yeah, I did go to court and tried to make the argument, and it was again, I didn't have the benefit of this knowledge or anything like that.
And how many papers did these lawyers write? How many lawyers were there, and wrote a paper or two or a dozen papers? I mean, how many papers did they flood the court with?
I'd have to get back with you on that, John, because like I said, I can't currently find my paperwork. I was in there as the plaintiff, and there is the defendant.
If you go get a copy of the docket, okay, and you go up and paste it, get a copy of the docket, and download all the papers that they filed. And if they only filed one or two papers and they're charging you $20,000, that's fraud right there.
Right. As far as I remember, there was only the one. Lawyer in the court. Maybe two, but they had brought a bunch of, well, four or five people, I think, from the bank to sit in and listen.
They don't get paid for anything. You know, the only ones would be any kind of a special witness that had to be paid to come in and make a statement or something or prove something, and then there would be, of course, you know, the lawyer themselves. And look, if a lawyer comes into court, they file a paper or two, and they charge you $20,000, that's a fraud. How do they go about getting that? Give an accounting of that. Give me a proof of...
accounting or something, maybe, huh?
Yeah, well, that's pretty much what it is. Proof of claim. Yeah, proof of claim. And so that's where I'd start digging around there. And let me tell you something. The way the court system is, you can probably develop a strategy for anything. Because of the way that they set things up, they're only Supreme Courts. Okay, and when you discover that the whole thing is a fraud, then you've never really, admitted to or agreed to the jurisdiction. They just drug you in there, and they did what they want, and you didn't know what was going on, and blah, 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 blah. And now you countersue them and go a different direction and open a court of record. You go after them for fraud, potentially, because I can't see how they can charge $20,000 for if the case only has a paper or two filed in, and they were in court one or two days. I mean, come on. That's crazy. Anyway, I'm going to go so Gerard can finish up on the call here. But Gerard, you still here?
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
Yeah, I got to go, so I'm just letting you finish up here.
Yeah, we're already over time, so what else we got?
Well, I guess that was the last call anyway.
That was it, yeah.
All right, Linda, I'd like to know how you work out on that, pulling up the document.
Right. It's the public site here in town is right down for repairs or something, so I can't say that.
What court was it? What was it, state court, county court?
It's the municipality of Anchorage. It was a state, let's see. In the District Superior Court for the State of Alaska at Anchorage.
Yeah, Alaska's a little funny, I think, with their...
But that word municipality, I mean, that's kind of shaking. That's all over the place, civil law. And that's where your battle is, the civil law. Not under civil law. And again,
right.
Are you in the course? I think you said you
were. I am.
Well, this Saturday, make sure you're there this Saturday, because I'm going to cover some information that might be helpful for you.
Yeah, that'd be great. So my next concern is, you know, this hearing potentially that's coming up, and according to their civil rules here, if they could potentially sell my house at auction to get this, is what they're saying.
Well,
if they got a judgment, they can. That's the way it goes.
There's the Homestead Act. When you bought your home, and you took a loan, I'm sure you were set up under the Homestead Act. And if you're under the Homestead Act and it's the home you live in, then they can't take it.
Well, actually, you got to do that yourself, John. They don't do it for you. I did mine. Nobody told me about it. I went and asked about it, and it was there.
Yeah, but if you have a lawyer, unless they're brain dead, I mean, doesn't file it.
Say again.
I'd go shoot the lawyer. I'm only kidding. I don't really mean that. Just a joke.
Yeah, under the Homestead Act, they can't take the home away that you're living in.
Right. So go check. Go down to the county building, and look up your property and see if it's filed under the Homestead Act. You can ask the clerk for assistance on that. They're always good down there to help you with the real property or the records.
That would end an offer, John. That would be the silver bullet, basically.
Yeah, that is.
Okay, that would be under the county records?
The only other problem you have is your income, and there's different ways to deal with that, depending if you're working for yourself or working for someone else. There's different ways to deal with that.
Right. So that would be the county recorder's office to go and check on if I've got a homestead?
Yeah, you go down to the county building and you go for the records room, probably is where you'll find that information. There's a real property, but I don't think you'll find it up there. It's down in the record rooms because that's where they record all the county business. And any home, any mortgage or any home that was bought down there, especially if there's a mortgage on it, but it doesn't matter. It's listed down there, and you'll see if the Homestead Act was in there. How long ago did you buy the house?
2006.
And do you have contact with the lawyer who set it up and did it?
No.
Do you know who it is that you can call them up and say, hey, remember me? Because they'll know.
Okay, no, I mean, I can look at my mortgage paperwork and see whose name is on there.
Those are the things you need to do, that and get the docket and find out how many papers were filed, get a copy of the papers that were filed, and see what's up. I'm sure the papers were probably no more than four or five papers, maybe six, and maybe they attached a bunch of BS to it, and then filing for a default. So, I mean, how much more could they have filed that they want $20,000 for? You want an account? An accounting. Matter of fact, that's where you should go right now, is push for that accounting. Anyway.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Yep. Have a good night. Thank you, everybody. See you next week, same time. God bless.